Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I am your host, Ken Molman, and this is the My View Matters radio network. Today's show is pre-recorded because I have work to do tonight during the show. I have a ridiculous amount of work going on these past few weeks, and as a result, I didn't want to just do another best-of show. We've done a lot of those since the new year. Put together a lot of new content for tonight. I had a lot lined up for the show, and so we'll just do it. We'll just do it pre-recorded, and as such, obviously, the phone lines are not going to be open tonight. I'm sorry about that. You can always hit us on the Facebook page and leave your feedback there, and obviously, we hope you'll continue to tell your friends and family about the show, and normally, we'll be here live, and we should be back here live next week, so we look forward to seeing you then. So getting right to it here, tonight, we start with the random political rhetoric generator, as we do every week, and this week's randomly generated political rhetoric is, I will not stand for an America where internet pirates and Wall Street insiders can corrupt our founding fathers' dreams. Ah, the good old political rhetoric generator, always good for a laugh. We'll start out tonight, found an interesting link over at opensecrets.org. They track money in politics, and they have a top all-time donors from 1989 to 2014. So basically, the last quarter century, which groups have collected and spent the most money on electoral politics. And there are quite a number of PACs in here. What I really find interesting is that basically, until you get down to number 17, which is UPS, number 1 through 16 are either Democrat tilt, heavy Democrat tilt, or on the fence. And I think that's pretty interesting that those on the left are usually the ones that decry the amount of money in politics, but at the same time, it's their PACs that are probably the most, the ones that spend the most on the ones that spend the most on candidates. It's the left-leaning PACs that are bringing home the bacon and are the ones that are specifically spending the most money in politics. And I just find that interesting. It's quite a bit of money. I mean, over 25 years, of course, is kind of a long time. But the number one group here is called Act Blue. And Act Blue actually only got its start in 2004, so it's been around for about a decade. And in that decade, they've spent almost $100 million. So they're spending about $10 million a year on average. And, of course, I'm sure that they don't spend every single year because there's not an election every single year. So that's a good bit of money. And for a group that... what's interesting about them is that the way they're set up, and I started looking into this since they were the top pack, the way they're set up is very, very interesting. They are set up as a pack, but they let you earmark your donations toward a certain candidate, which is really dancing the line. The entire point of a pack is that it's supposed to be independent of a campaign. And by specifically allowing donations to come in for a specific candidate, explicitly for, now make no mistake, there are many PACs out there that are completely bogus in what they claim. They're just fronts for other candidates' campaigns and ways to skirt around the campaign finance laws. We saw that, I think it was the super PAC that was supporting Newt Gingrich in 2012. If I remember that right. I know there was a super PAC on a Republican, and I think it was Newt Gingrich. We're basically, it was just a guy who had a bunch of money that he wanted to spend on a particular candidate. And in fact, that's happened here in Kentucky, too. I mean, I remember in 2011, there was the group that was set up by the now ex-father-in-law of Senator David Williams in the 2011 gubernatorial race, where millions of dollars were dumped into a PAC that was really there to push David Williams. on that same topic, what's interesting, something I saw here a couple, 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, was a study that said that the amount of money being spent in a race, at some point there's basically the law of diminishing returns kicks in. And at some point, no matter how much more money you spend, it doesn't change the outcome of the race. Now, I tend to agree with that at some point a media market gets overflooded or mailboxes get overstuffed and it doesn't matter anymore. But basically, this study showed that once you reach a certain point, you're not getting a whole lot of bang for your buck. Now, what's interesting about that, tying this into topics that we've had on the show in the past, the Virginia governor's race last year, the Virginia gubernatorial candidate from the Republican side blamed being cut off by the National Party for his loss. Now, there were a number of people in the media that blamed the existence of a Libertarian candidate for his loss, but the candidate himself blames the being cut off of money. And essentially, towards the end of the race, the Democratic candidate was outraising the Republican candidate by about 3-1. Now, certainly there is a point of diminishing returns, but that race was, in the end, pretty close. The Democratic candidate did win with less than 50% of the vote. The Republican candidate lost by, I want to say it was about 4% or so. There's a real possibility that that fundraising differential actually did have a significant effect. And basically, the study says that all these millions of dollars that are being spent in these big, high-priced campaigns only budge things a point or two. Well, if you budge it a point or two, if you're able to take 2 points off of your competitor and put 2 points on your category, that actually could have swung the outcome in Virginia governor's race 2013. So there is a legitimate claim to be made that at some point you get the diminishing returns, but in a very tight election, certainly money does matter. And that is, in my opinion, also, especially when you get down towards the beginning of the race, you do need a certain amount of money to get things started, to get things rolling. And that's what really hampers the ability of third-party and independent candidates in general to be able to get ahead, to be able to win an election, is specifically that, the lack of startup capital. Every campaign, depending on its size, has a certain entry cost. Now, ignoring the fact that the Democrats and Republicans in most states have made it so that there's an additional burden that non-Republican, non-Democratic candidates have to reach, which adds an additional financial burden just to get things started, there is a basic amount of money required to get into any race. You're going to need things like push cards and yard signs and things like that at a minimum. You're going to need a website. You're going to need a Facebook presence. You're going to need those types of things. All of those things do cost money, if not time, or really both. The point being that money does have a role to play in politics. And it's unfortunate but true, and part of that is the nature of our political system, that the way things are set up these days, you're going to have bigger and bigger races. Something I've pointed out to a number of people, and I may have mentioned it on the show before. Our original United States Congress had approximately 33,000 people, and you have to put people in air quotes because of this horrible three-fifths clause, but 33,000 people per congressman. Today, that number is closer to about 700 and something thousand people per congressman. So essentially, our Congress is 20 times less representative than it used to be. By comparison, our state house districts in Kentucky have about 44,000 people per congressman, per house district. And that means that our state house districts are 33% less representative than the original United States congressional seats. Now think about what that means. That means you're talking about bigger races. Bigger races mean you have more costs. If you're in a small race, if you're in a city council race, you, depending on the city, right, as long as it's not a city like Louisville or Lexington, if you're in a normal Kentucky city, you're not going to need that much money to run for that office. And by the way, if you haven't signed up, you probably should if your city is, if you live in the city and it's not one that does a primary, it's still not too late to sign up. You can make a difference at the city council level. But a city council race, you're going to need some push cards and you're going to need some, a new pair of shoes. Those are going to be your costs when you run for a local office, something you can literally knock on every door in the area, introduce yourself, tell people who you are, why you're running, and try to earn their support. That is entirely doable. By contrast, a U.S. congressional campaign, you cannot do that. You cannot knock on the door of 725,000 people, and certainly it'd be fewer homes. We're, probably down somewhere around 250,000 homes. You still don't have time to knock on 250,000 homes and introduce yourself. It's just not possible. And so money makes up the difference. And because these races are so big, and because these races do require so much money, and because our government has obtained way more power than it ever should have had, there's more and more on the line in these races. People redirecting money to different special causes, redirecting money to their cronies, their friends, rewarding their donors with contracts. These things happen all over the United States, and they happen right here in Kentucky. They happen here. A lot. You'd be surprised. The more I've dug into politics, the more I realize that pretty much every county that I've examined, actually, at this point, every county I've examined has a political establishment behind the scenes. And that political establishment does not care if you are a Democrat, a Republican, an independent, whatever. They care if you can win or not, and if you're going to give them what they want. That's what they care about. And so what ends up happening is the system starts to self-corrupt at that point. You start into this cycle of money where you need more money to win the race, so you've got to do more favors to those people after the race is complete if you win. And then in turn, because you did those favors, they go the elected official goes back to those same people and say, hey, you know, we did this for you. What do we want to do next time for you? And they get even more money. And it corrupts the process. The problem with not being able to actually go out and shake hands with every single voter that's going to be voting on you on election day is that that process inherently corrupts itself. And that's a problem. It is a real problem. And unfortunately, nobody actually wants to talk about the solution, which is increasing representation, increasing the number of people who are elected. And that it's funny because the political establishment will then run around and say, you're for big government. Ha, 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 that's a big government thing. But it's not a big government thing. It's a representative government thing. And if we are to have a representative government, we need to have the number of voices needs to increase as the population increases. Otherwise, your government is inherently getting less and less representative every day. That's just the way it is. It's just math. And as things get less representative, it encourages more of that corruption. It encourages more of the stuff that's breaking our country. And that's a bad thing. We don't want that. Boy, was it last week or so, Jon Stewart had Nancy Pelosi on The Daily Show. And Stewart was bringing up, you know, part of this argument that the money is corrupting politics. And it is. What he's not addressing or failing to address is why is so much money needed. But it's true. Money does corrupt politics because you need all that money. It corrupts things, as I've just outlined. So, Pelosi, entertainingly, says, oh, no, there's no problem with money corrupting politics. No. Certainly not. And when it comes down to it, I mean, really, we're not dealing with necessarily the brightest bulb in the bunch here. I mean, this is the, we need to pass it to see what's in it person. I mean, really, that's the worst line ever for passing legislation is, I have no idea what's in this, I'm just going to vote yes, and then we'll find out. Ha ha ha! That's an ignorant line. But regardless of that, she says, well, no, there's no corruption. What are you talking about, corruption? Money corrupting? No. And then Stewart continues to press her, and then finally, she says, well, maybe the Republicans are corrupt, but certainly not us Democrats. Ha ha ha. And then Stewart, a few days later, replayed part of that interview and then pointed out that a whole bunch of ambassadorships are basically being given away to people who were the top donor bundlers for Obama's campaign. That's corruption. These people had no experience with the countries that they were being made ambassadors of. That's corruption. They're basically unqualified to do the job, but are being given the job because they're insiders. They became insiders by bundling all the money for the campaign. There you go. And you know it's funny because I ran into another article here about the mayor of or the former mayor of New Orleans. Ray Nagin is going to go to jail for corruption. And New Orleans was a big, you know, was a very big city. It's still a big city. A lot of people in poverty, a lot of people oppressed and kept in poverty, so they keep voting for the same people, my opinion. That's the problem. We have a lot of corruption in our system. And in my opinion, and I'm open to suggestions, I mean, I'm looking for other answers. I'm looking for other alternatives. But the only alternative I see at this point is to increase representation, to make these races smaller so that regular people can win them again. Regular people can't win a U.S. congressional race, generally speaking. Because regular people don't have $2 million in their back pocket that they're willing to spend on a campaign for U.S. Congress. But that's how much money you need, a minimum of $1 million to jump into a U.S. congressional race at this point. Whether you have it in your pocket or other people are pledging it or whatever, you're going to need about $1 million to run for U.S. Congress. Do you have $1 million? If so, I'd like to talk to you, because I don't, but I can find someone. If you're looking to get rid of that $1 million, I can find a very legitimate candidate for you to donate it to. Most of the U.S. Senate races are a minimum of $5 million. I mean, you could probably get away in certain states, maybe smaller states with sparse populations. You might be able to get away with $1 million for that. But generally, you're talking about $5 million. State House races, even here in Kentucky, you're going to need somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000 to $50,000 to run for State House. And depending on who you're running against, you might need more. We've seen certain people who are protected by the party, their respective parties, are protected insiders. When they perceive that those folks are in trouble, they just drop a bundle of money on those folks. And, you know, we saw in, I think it was 2012. Yeah, 2012. We saw people dropping 120 grand into a state house race, which is a phenomenally huge amount of money for a state house race. But again, unless you've got 120 grand that you're willing to contribute, or really, at a minimum, you need 25 grand to jump into a house race, legitimately. That's what you need to get going. And the signature requirements and all that aren't that bad on a state house race. So you can get into a state house race for about 25 grand and run a legitimate campaign. If you do the work, you do the door-to-door, you can run a legitimate campaign at 25 grand. But if you're outspent, if your competition drops 120K against you, that's going to be hard to overcome. My rule of thumb is if you get outspent by about 4-1, you're toast. Toast. And that's why money is so involved in this. Yeah, there is diminishing returns when both candidates are spending upwards of $5 and $10 million in what is essentially a statewide race, a gubernatorial race or a congressional race. I mean, that's a ridiculous amount of money to spend in a congressional race. It's been done, but it's a ridiculous amount of money. And then when parties are trying to hold on to particular seats or trying to make sure they maintain their majority or control of some committee or general legislative body or whatever, the money can get absolutely ridiculous. That's what we saw in 2012, by the way, was the Democrats were very worried the Republicans were going to take over the state house, and they dropped like $120,000 into a handful of races where the Republican competitor only spent, you know, $35,000-$40,000. I mean, that's normal, right? I mean, 35 to 40 is pretty plain. At the same time, we did see outside groups from outside Kentucky drop money into Kentucky's primary campaigns. Specifically, I'm talking about the state House and state Senate races, where some outside group was dropping, you know, between $25,000 and $50,000 worth of promotional materials to build name ID for a particular candidate. And unfortunately, that's totally legal, and they didn't even have to put a paid for buy on it, which I pretty much find disgusting that you can still do that kind of thing. I don't care necessarily about the amount of money spent. I do, but I don't, right? I think individuals should be allowed to give whatever they want, but free speech, free political speech in the form of political contributions should not be anonymous. I think that's an important part of our system, is that openness and knowing who is funding who ensures that we as voters make a better decision on election day. I think that that's important. So, there's money to go around. There's money that if you cuddle up with the right special interests, they'll dump money in your lap, but they're going to certainly expect something in return. And if you fail, they'll be spending against you the next time. So that's how things get corrupted. That's how, and I've seen even people who seem anyway to have started out with the right intentions over time have been corrupted. And as I mentioned, it's all over the state. It's everywhere. It's like every year or two, we see the insanity that is an Eastern Kentucky judge, executive, sheriff, or both get arrested by the feds. I mean, it's crazy. Absolutely crazy. And why does that happen? It happens because there's power, there's money. Because there's a stranglehold in the county, even, over who's wielding power. And a lot of it is divvying up county resources in a way that earns enough votes to win. There's certainly a lot of that. There's always the allegations of vote buying, generally out of Eastern Kentucky. But there's basically two ways to solve the money corruption, the money causing the corruption. There's one of two ways you can solve it. Number one, you can try to limit the amount of money in politics. And that's been tried. Citizens United, it's gone. Well, it's gone for corporations. Individuals, we still have a limit. Don't you see, no matter what you do, if you try to make it so that people are limited, it will backfire. It will work against us. Instead, what we can do is increase representation. And we can do that in a way that we can lower the salaries of people who are being paid. We can cut their staff, because in theory they have less to work on, right? They're now just focused on a smaller area. Increasing representation may end up costing more money, though. It may. And in the end, I always go back to say, look, the expenses involved in having a democratically elected republic are there. They absolutely are there. They're real. But wouldn't you rather have a democratically elected republic with high expenses involved in having all these people come to Frankfurt, or in the case of the national side, going to Washington, D.C. and flying back and forth and all of that? Wouldn't you rather have that than a dictatorship? Certainly a dictatorship would be a far cheaper thing, at least initially, because there's only one person. You only have to pay one person. Heck, you can cram all kinds of legislation through. I mean, boy, there's nobody to stop it. There's no checks and balances on the system. That'd be something to cram stuff right on through. I believe the best solution is to increase representation. And would it slow some legislation down? Why, certainly it would. And is that really a bad thing? No. That's when all these caps came about on our representation, was back during a time when they decided everything needed to be crushed through, and boy, we need to make a lot of changes, and boy, we need to change stuff. And here's the thing about change. Change is not a bad thing, but rapid change can be, because you're not waiting to see the results of one thing before you go do another. And you don't know what the downstream effects of the first change are before you're implementing yet another. And it convolutes policy, and it becomes very difficult to determine whether a particular policy was effective or not. Additionally, you're introducing a high rate of change, which is, by the way, extremely damaging to the economy, because people in general don't like rapid change, and businesses really don't like rapid change. If you want to know why we're still in recession, we've talked about this on the show before, it's Obamacare. It's the uncertainty. People don't know. And they keep dorking with it and moving stuff around and moving the timeline around, and that just continues the instability. It continues to perpetuate the question marks that are in the minds of business owners, preventing them from hiring because they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. The solution is more representation. Individuals get a louder voice, not pure democracy. We do not want pure democracy. Though I could be talked into, I do support a mechanism for recalling any law by popular vote. In other words, if the majority of the public does not like a law, we should be able to get rid of that law by popular vote as a check and balance on the legislature, if you will. But otherwise, we don't want to have a democracy. Democracies are dangerous, too, for a whole other myriad of reasons. But if we're going to have a representative republic, then it has to actually be representative. That's the key. It has to be representative. And most people, if you ask them on the street today, will tell you they don't feel like their representative actually represents them. They don't know that guy from Adam. They don't know that woman from Eve. They don't know those people. Now, they may like them, they may like some of the policies, but they don't know them. So, the point is, we need better representation to fix this problem. Not campaign finance reform, not constitutional amendments, we don't need any of that. Heck, it's really easy to undo most of the damage. There's just a law on the books in Congress that capped Congress at 435 representatives. Here in Kentucky, we can undo the law or increase the number of people in the state house and the state senate. I mean, let's just double the number. 200 in the house, 76 in the senate. Easy. Done. Cut their staff in half, cut their pay in half, whatever, I don't care. Do both. Do all of it. It'll make things better. I can promise you it'll make things better. It'll make it so that the people who get elected are far more likely to actually know their neighbors, to know the issues that concern the people that they're actually supposed to be representing. And isn't that the real goal anyway? All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got more. Stay tuned. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network.
Okay. first impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop. Over 50 years, one source, one solution. erniesprintshop.com. 502-969-8585.
Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springson of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, folks. We're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled here on the My View Matters radio network. And just a reminder, there are shows on the network at 7 p.m. Sunday through Thursday. Monday through Wednesday is the Ed Springsteen Show, and Thursday is Thursday Night Truth with Dale the Truth. Tune in to those shows as well. All right, so getting back to it here. It's been rather cold outside. I'm sure you've all noticed. I've got my fill of shoveling the driveway for the next decade or so. That's plenty of snow, please. Thank you. No, don't need any more. Thanks. But It did, of course, bring out all the folks, the global warming debate, and, you know, it's always during winter when the global warming people take the biggest beating because it's cold. But this year was especially cold, and we saw some colder than usual weather, and it'll be interesting to see how that all gets aggregated together. But what I can tell you is that the alarmists amongst the global warming crowd have yet again been proven to be idiots. And by that, I mean Al Gore. Al Gore, 5 years ago, as of December, so in December of 2008, predicted the North Polar ice cap would be completely melted in 5 years, which would have been back in December. And needless to say, that didn't happen. Haven't heard anything about the North Pole being gone or melted away. You know, that's really the problem with that kind of prediction. First of all, you don't really know that. Second of all, you're taking a worst-case scenario projection, and you're laying your credibility onto it. I get this problem a lot when I talk to various people within the Libertarian Party, which, you know, of course I'm deeply involved with. In case you didn't know, there you go. There's a lot of people who want myself or the party or both to put a lot of credibility behind one person or one particular predicted outcome or scenario. And, you know, quite honestly, I'm not really willing to do that just on a wing and a prayer. I mean, there are some things that it's pretty easy to figure out what's going to happen, right? I mean, for instance, the smoking ban issue. That's one that I've done extensive research on. It's pretty cut and dry. There are businesses that are hurt by a smoking ban, and the overwhelming majority of those are the local mom-and-pop places, mostly bars, also 24-hour diners. That's who's going to be hurt by a smoking ban. And so, you know, that's easy for me to call out. It's easy for me to point out. It's easy for me to predict that because it's pretty straightforward. It's cause and effect. It's done. It's done. You know, global warming is not, or climate change as it is now, is not simple. There's a lot of moving parts, and quite honestly, we don't have a lot of data to support either side. You're looking back at about 100 years worth of data-ish, because the data is not as complete then as it is now. So you're looking at an incomplete set of data from 100 years ago, comparing it to a more complete set of data now, and then trying to make an assertion of what's going to happen in the next 20 years based off only 100 years of history in a scenario where there is what? I don't even know how old the Earth is and all that anymore. It's a lot. So, and of course there's debate on that, but I don't want to even go there. The point is that there's, you're looking at a very small subset of data. Quite honestly, the sample size is not large enough. The sample size, both from a time period and from a how many points of data, you would really have to know the aggregate temperature of the entire planet for the entire period to be able to start to establish a pattern. And then the problem is that you cannot account for or adjust for natural climate cycles because there's just not enough data. There's nothing going back beyond about 100 years or so. And so even if there is global warming, you don't know. You just don't know. You can't account for or factor out the effect of natural warming and cooling trends. And we do know that those have happened. We do know that there have been ice ages. We do know that there have been floods. We do know that there has been all these different things. We have evidence of that, and certainly we don't really know what caused those things because nobody was paying attention or nobody was even around. So the point is that, is pollution bad? Sure. Pollution's bad. Of course it is. Who wants to breathe sulfur and, you know, the nitrous oxides and all that stuff? Nobody wants to breathe that stuff. And of course, it's a good thing to continue to reduce that. And of course, any policy in that front needs to be grounded in rationality and take a gradual approach so that it doesn't, you know, in the case of our power plants, cause a rate shock in the market, which is exactly what's going on now. But it's something that the free market can adjust to over time. It's something that we should reduce because, quite honestly, it's not good. We should not have to breathe sulfur or nitrous oxides or any of the nasty chemicals. Is carbon dioxide a nasty chemical? I don't think so. I don't think it's nasty. Could there be a situation where there's too much of it? Well, sure, of course. But at the same time, in theory anyway, if that were to occur, nature would kick in. You would have plants that would be flourishing as a result, and they produce oxygen. So there is a yin and a yang factor to it all. And so I don't know. It just, again, it's kind of a good lesson in why not to put all your chips in one basket. Why not, you know, for the people that get all behind Al Gore, you know, he said a number of things now that have made him sound incompetent. I know there was a quote of him going around saying that the core of the Earth was millions of degrees, which obviously it's not. And of course, he also is credited with, self-credited with creating the internet, but that's another story for another day. The point is that just be careful what you're getting behind or getting behind any individual. I really try not to latch onto any individual because that way I can't be disappointed. And, you know, quite honestly, latching onto one individual, if you build everything behind one person, people are fallible. People make mistakes, and you don't want your entire philosophy or your entire premise to be destroyed simply because one person made some sort of silly mistake. So moving on, one of the things here that's in my stack that I found interesting is that support for the death penalty has been dropping rather steadily over the course of almost 20 years now, just shy of 20 years. In 1996, the death penalty was favored by 78% of Americans. And in March of 2013, the support is down to 55%. And of course, opposition, therefore, has risen. There's still a group in the middle that just don't know because, as we always talk about on the show, those people in the middle that don't know, they're always don't know. There's always about 7% of people in any poll that have no idea what you're talking about, which is kind of worrisome. But anyway, the point is that here,
by a margin of 55 to 37, Americans still do favor the death penalty. But that is going down, and I think that that's a good thing, both from a financial standpoint and from a – the death penalty is rather final. You can't go, oops, we made a mistake after you've executed someone. We also, a few weeks back, saw the folks in Ohio executed someone, and that went very, very badly. It took a very long time. It seems by the description that was given, it sounds like he dry drowned, which is when you the anesthetics or whatever cause your body to drown, even though you're not in water. So that's not good. And I quipped kind of jokingly, you know, there were two articles about side by side. One was about how the heroin epidemic's out of control and people are dying left and right. And then there was the article about the botched death penalty the botched execution in Ohio. And I was like, you know, if heroin's such an efficient killer, and the whole thing with Ohio was that the old drug, they couldn't get it anymore, and so they had to try this new cocktail, seems to me like heroin might be the right way to go. I mean, you know, hey, if all the fear-mongering about heroin is true, and, you know, I have no reason to doubt that it's not true, at least to some extent, you know, maybe that's the way to do it, and you could get the heroin off the streets and use it to execute people. Not that I'm saying we should be executing people, but just whatever. It was kind of a joke. I just found that kind of funny. You have, on one hand, the state can't seem to execute somebody right, and on the other hand, you've got heroin killing people, and that's in the same newspaper with headlines side by side. Just whatever. Let's see, what else is there here? The marijuana issue is always out there. We've got the push for medical marijuana here in Kentucky. It's got popular support. I do not expect that to pass this year, quite honestly, but I do think that we're well on our way. There's more and more examples out there. There are more examples out there that of people getting help specifically with seizures through medical marijuana. Through derivatives of medical marijuana. These are things that are not legal in Kentucky, and so you have people leaving Kentucky and going to places like Colorado to get them not to get high, but to actually use them as medication for children who are having seizures. And there are ways to do this without the THC, without the intoxicant in marijuana. And in fact, you know, industrial hemp, which it sounds like might actually happen, which I'm very excited about, and we'll have to get Katie back on here at some point in the near future from the Industrial Hemp Museum. I would love to see if hemp could be used for some of this as well, and I think that it could. So just another reason why hemp is a good thing for the state of Kentucky. Oh, I did find it funny. The person who sponsored the medical marijuana bill in the Senate, or someone who has said they support it on the Republican side, is also supporting the smoking ban in the Senate as well. And that's been filed, that's been pushed to a committee, and it'll probably die there. But in the House, the smoking ban has gotten to the floor. There's been four floor amendments filed. Chances are good they'll never past those. And in case anyone was wondering, I started checking. There's only like 5 or 10 states total that have a ban in place that is equal to or more extreme than what Kentucky's looking at passing. So when they throw around the numbers about 38 states have a ban, yeah, they do kind of, but not like what they're trying to pass here. There are exemptions in those. But anyway, the reason I bring this up, one of the things that's come out recently is that the Department of Health and Human Services is basically blackmailing colleges into going smoke-free campus. And essentially it's about whether or not they get grant money from the Department of Health and Human Services to continue research at their university. And as a result, basically this is the same kind of silliness that we saw with the alcohol laws, where they made it so that you had to be 21, and also under Clinton, where they made all the states jack up their smoking age to 18. It was all tied to federal highway dollars in that scenario. In this scenario, it's tied to DHHS grant money. And, you know, it's really, in my opinion, it's wrong. I don't think that grant money, you know, should be used as a carrot or a stick, because in the end, that money is our money. It's not like it came from a private investor. That's tax money being used to push policy. And whether or not that policy has merit or not, tax money should not be promoting policy like that. It should not be pushing legislative agendas. It should not be pushing such things. And I have a real big problem with that. And I guess on that front, you know, one of the things about that is the science is always in flux. I mean, they like to say that the science on the smoking stuff is over, but there was just another study that came out not a month ago that said, oh, yeah, by the way, secondhand smoke, not really harmful unless you live with a smoker for 30 or more years. Now, that's not saying that it's good for you, but it's saying that the craziness, the hysteria that the pro-ban people stir up is completely false. And that's a lot of this. It's a scientific, it's pseudoscience hysteria that gets stirred up. I found another study on that front here, completely different topic, but still science, quote-unquote science related, is that when a mother, the childbirth is going long, it's not necessarily a bad thing. And basically what they're saying now is that with the modern monitors and whatnot, they can tell if the baby's in distress and they can take action then. But otherwise, there's no reason to really force the matter. Let the mother's body do what it's going to do. And this is something that, again, it's kind of like the silliness around salt and butter and all that stuff where it goes back and forth. Is salt good for you or bad for you today? You know, whatever. At the end of the day, all things in moderation, do things right, and, you know, try to do them as natural as you can. I would much rather have natural salt and natural butter than the artificial substitutes. I think that the natural stuff is better for you in general. That's my opinion. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a nutritionist. That's just my gut tells me that it's better to be taking things that are more natural, and the more natural, the better. But that all things in moderation, the more you have, if you overdo it, you're going to have problems. Oh, boy. This issue. One of the things that's been on the queue for a few weeks, or for a week or so now, is Philip Seymour Hoffman. Libertarians are being blamed for the death of an actor who was a heroin addict, and they're, you know, running around saying, see, libertarian policies would kill this guy. That's what killed him. And the reality is that that's not at all the case. That certainly, any time that something is allowed to occur, people may abuse it. Just like with smoking or with salt or with butter. I mean, just ask Bloomberg. He's trying to cut back on the big gulps and the salt, right? I mean, you can overdo those things. The question is, how much of a nanny state do you really want? Is doing heroin bad for you? Well, yeah. Especially since when you're buying off the black market, there's no dosage control. And especially, you know, if you do develop a habit, it's a criminal thing. You can't just walk in and get some help. And so there are ways to really modify what we do at a fundamental level that would actually improve the situation. But fear-mongering about, oh, well, you just want to legalize this and you want people laying in the streets dying. Of course nobody wants that. I mean, come on, really? And so the point is that there are better policies out there. I always go back to Portugal. Portugal is an example of what can work. And that's something that we should be looking at. If it can work, let's do it. Or let's at least look at it. It's working for them. Maybe it needs to be tweaked for us, but it's a start. It's got to be better than what we're doing. It's better than what they were doing before. And speaking of the nanny state, you know, one of the downsides of the nanny state, beyond the fact that they're controlling every decision of your life, is that political motivations can come into play too. And if you give the nanny state the power to take things away arbitrarily, you're also giving them the power to take it away, not just for health reasons, but for political reasons. And Boy, this is going back a couple of months now, but California regulators were trying to regulate sriracha sauce. And they were doing so because basically the neighbors complained of the smell as the production ramped up because it's a very popular sauce. I know my son loves that stuff. I'm not a big fan personally, but my son likes it. My wife likes it. You know, they like that sauce. And so we have it here in the house and whatever. They're trying to ban the importing and production of it, basically on the premise that it's an uncooked product. But the funny thing is other sauces that are similar, like Tabasco, are also uncooked. It's the type of sauce that it is. And so now things that we've had for decades, right, like Tabasco sauce, are all of a sudden a health threat. Really? Really? And I love when they classify them as an emergency. That's my favorite. That goes back to the smoking thing. It's a health epidemic. Really? Epidemic? You may want to say it's an epidemic to justify the health departments jumping in and just doing stuff. Because they are enabled in Kentucky to jump in. If there really were an epidemic, you know, if there were some outbreak of the flu, of the avian flu, they are empowered to jump in because they want to stop the spread of that disease and save lives. But those are all acute conditions. Those are things that are extremely contagious, infectious diseases. That's why they have that power. Not because the legislators ever thought in the 50s when they gave them this power that they'd come after smoking. And of course not, especially not in the 50s, did they ever expect them to come after things like smoking. Certainly it's been known for quite some time that smoking is not good for you, but these health departments, these nanny staters, they're out of control. They want to make sure you don't do anything that could possibly hurt you. And I got news for you, folks. Every single thing you do in some way does hurt you. Just walking wears down your knees, but not walking makes you fat. So no matter what, it's a catch-22. It's, no matter what you do, it's bad for you. I don't know. Well, folks, I've got to wrap it up here tonight. I've got work, as I mentioned, killing me. I appreciate you all tuning in, and we do hope to be back here live next week rather than pre-recorded because I do want your phone calls. I do like your feedback, and I do hope that you'll tell your friends and family to listen to this and the other shows on the network. So until next week, folks, have a good week, and you've been listening to Liberty Unbridled from My View Matters Radio Network. Take care.